Very special welcome to all of you who are here visiting with us. We're thinking these days, as I'm speaking to the chapel of our student body, about the whole issue of stress and what a toll it takes on us, the whole problem with the growing anxiety that attempts to steal from us the joy of our lives. One of our students passed on to me a pretty good definition of stress not too long ago. It's that confusion created when one's mind overrides the body's desire to choke the living daylights out of some jerk who desperately needs it. Not bad. What is it in the realm of stress that has you worried today? Each one of us has our own list. Interestingly, our lists differ, but the effects on us remains the same. You might not know it, but there is a National Anxiety Center in Maplewood, New Jersey, and this particular group of bureaucrats has come up with the top 10 anxieties of our nation. These are the monster worries of our times. And it's not a fun list. It's a true list. In their opinion, the list should read as follows in the order of importance. 1, AIDS. 2, drug abuse. 3, nuclear waste. 4, the ozone layer. 5, famine. 6, the homeless. 7, the federal deficit. 8, air pollution. 9, water pollution. 10, garbage. Now then, without taking away for one moment the seriousness of anyone or all of them, I really doubt that any one of these is on your list. Isn't that interesting? Those who put together a list that our nation should be concerned about somehow miss the things that concern us deeply and bring that kind of stress I referred to earlier. Now, I could spend the rest of our time with you in sort of a woeful pity party addressing one worry after another. And rather than doing that, let's sort of analyze the whole issue of anxiety. And I'd like you to turn, to begin with, to Philippians chapter 4. Some very familiar verses from Paul's letter to these who existed in the first century, and yet, though first century in date, this is 20th century in relevance. For the things he says have as much to do with our lives today as they did with those lives in that day. Verse 4 begins with a great word, and it is the opposite of that which happens when we are filled with stress and anxiety and worry. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. You can hardly read the verse without a smile. He says it once, and he says it in conclusion. I say it again, rejoice. And please observe, it is a rejoicing in the Lord rather than in our times or in the midst of our stresses. Rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say, rejoice. Let your forbearing spirit, it's the whole idea of an enduring attitude. Let our forbearing spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. And then the command, after the previous two commands, to rejoice and to let our forbearing spirit be known, he says, be anxious for nothing. I suppose we could paraphrase it by turning it around and causing it to say, stop worrying about anything. Be anxious for nothing. Stop worrying about anything. Corrie ten Boom, for the last 2 years of her life, spent it in our congregation out in Fullerton, California. It was a wonderful experience to have this godly woman in our midst during that extended period of time as we literally watched her die. She said on one occasion, worry does not empty tomorrow of sorrows, it empties today of strength. I believe she's right. She was right about most things, so why should that be surprising? Stop worrying about anything, or you will lose the strength for today, to say nothing of its attack on your life tomorrow. And then the other side of the coin, but instead of worrying about anything, pray about everything. Worry about nothing, pray about everything. Will you say that with me? Worry about nothing, pray about everything. And please observe, in the prayer, it follows a pattern. In everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, send your request heavenward. Make your requests, let your requests be made known to God. Before passing on to the benefits that come from doing that, look back at the word anxious. Anxious. It means to divide, to be distracted. It came to mean to be annoyed, troubled, distressed. I find it interesting that the idea of physical strangulation enters into the whole thought of worry. In fact, the German Wurgen is from which we get worry. It means to choke. Literally to choke. Interesting, isn't it, in this day of basketball, when someone has a chance to make that last winning shot and he's at that free throw line and about to put the ball up in the hoop, all the people behind do all of the crazy things humans tend to do when they don't want the shot to be made. And if he misses it, you go like, choke, choke. That's what I think of when I think of the word worry. Stop choking. Stop allowing the stresses of our times to strangle you. But in contrast to that worry and its attack on your today and invariably your tomorrow, let your requests be made known to God. If the truth were known, our worry lists are longer than our prayer lists. You could tell me more quickly what you're worrying about than you could tell me what you're praying about. And I could do the same. He says, as a result of praying and bringing it all before God, there comes a peace, verse 7. A calming sense of serenity. I think it's the best gift of heaven. And the peace of God that surpasses all understanding shall march sentry duty, shall guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. I read some years ago about a man who had worried over his business for as long as he owned the business. He was a partner with another man in the business, and the other partner was given to anxiety and intensity, and so was this man. He learned the lesson well, and he lived for years restless at night, worried during the day over his business. He went to a seminar where they taught the value of trusting God rather than trying to work it all out yourself, and he decided in that seminar would be the last day that he would worry about his business. In fact, came home that evening, said to his wife before he went to bed, "I've decided the business is God's. Whatever happens is up to him." In the middle of that night, while he was in a deep sleep, his phone rang and woke him up. He grabbed the receiver, and it was his partner who said, "Come now, our place is on fire." He quickly dressed, drove to the place where he had worked for years, and stood on the road adjacent to the business and watched it going up in smoke. And was sort of laughing. As his partner came alongside and said to him, "What in the world are you doing? Laughing. I mean, everything we have is going up in smoke. He said, listen, man, last night I decided to give this business to God. It's His. And if He wants to burn it up, that's His business. Whatever He wants to do with it. What a wonderful way to live. You say, that sounds pretty irresponsible to me. Stop and think. How in the world would his worry have helped stop the fire? How in the world would anxiety have assisted him in his load of stress? That's the strangeness about worry. While we're analyzing its choking effect on us, we tend to forget that it does no good whatsoever. Our Lord himself said, you do not add one inch to your stature or one year to your lifespan by worrying. In fact, the truth is, you take away from the years of your life. Some of you today have become masters in worry. There was a lady in our church that I frequently encountered who said to me on one occasion, if I don't have something to worry about, I'm worried that I don't have something to worry about. I mean, it was her security blanket. How much better to say, I have decided when this thing comes in to choke the living daylights out of my joy, I'm going to give it to God. That's my first response. I'm going to give it to God. I was driving across West Texas coming here, and I happened to tune into Del Rio. It has a signal that reaches Latvia when you get across Del Rio. And this preacher was coming at the people over something on the radio. And since I have a kind of a passing interest in radio preachers, I listened to what he had to say. And he was chiding them about this and chiding them about that. And one fellow had written some critical letter to him, and he was answering the guy on the radio, and he said, I've just decided I'm going to sick God on you. I thought, that's another way to look at prayer. You can sort of sick God on people. You don't like what's happening? Sick them. God, it's up to you. You'll need that someday. You'll need it. By the way, when I think about choking, go back to Mark chapter 4 for just a moment before we wind up in Luke chapter 10. Mark 4 includes a whole series of things Jesus spoke of in a parable called the parable of the sower, where the farmer sows seed in different kinds of soil. There's hard soil, and there's rocky soil, and there is thorny soil, and there is good fertile soil, and each of the soils bear different kind of crops. Nothing wrong with the seed, but there's something wrong with the soil. And the soil is a picture of the soul, obviously. Jesus doesn't leave this to the imagination of a preacher to interpret the parable. In fact, he interprets it for us. And what interests me is the 19th verse where he interprets the thorny soil. Please observe how he interprets the thorns of life, the worries of the world, the deceitfulness caused by riches, and the desires for other things. It's a picture of envy, always wanting more, never being satisfied, lack of contentment in life. The desire to have something else before I can say, finally, I can relax. The worries of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, the desire for more and more and more. Enter in. And what is the word that's used here? Choke. There it is again. But what does it choke? Choke's the word. And that's the whole point of the parable, for the word to be sown in a heart so that the heart bears fruit and the life begins to reveal the life of Jesus Christ on this earth, which is what the Christian life is all about. Before that takes place, the thorns choke it out. And they somehow affect our memory. We forget some great thought that God gave us or that someone passed on to us out of the Scriptures. And look at what happens. It all becomes unfruitful. I was sleeping the other evening, and I woke up choking. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. I was on my back, and Cynthia says, when you get on your back, strange things happen. So not only do you snore horribly, but she said, sometime you don't breathe, which concerns her a little bit at times. When and so she said, you breathe in, but you never want to breathe out. And she says, it's like, breathe. And so she gigged me with her elbow graciously the other evening, and I woke up strangling, and I could not get my breath. If you ever had that happen, it makes for great illustrations, but it's a terrible experience. And I jumped out of bed, and we're living right now in a little garage apartment, and the roof is slanted, and I banged my head as I got up, and I'm choking. I get hit in the head, and she's gigged me, and suddenly I had a momentary feeling that death would be better than what I was going through. I could not get my breath, and it's amazing I thought of nothing else in that choking moment. That's what worry does. It sends you into a vacuous existence where great teaching is lost, where marvelous biblical principles somehow don't get retrieved, where a thought that we had been hanging on to for the longest time is stolen from us. And it all becomes unfruitful because of the thorns brought on by anxiety, worry. What terrible dividends and consequences they pay. Finally, if you want an illustration of a person driven by worry, you must look at the last few verses of Luke chapter 10. And let me say, as you turn, with all apologies to you who are named Martha. Please understand that these are not my words. And so if you happen to be named Martha, it's just it's just an unusual coincidence that you are the one I'm referring to. And in case you're Mary, don't feel too proud because she comes off looking good here and Martha looking bad. The whole point is not the names. It's the response to a situation that one of these two ladies considered a reason for stress, while the other one considered it was an opportunity of the moment. Travel back with me to the first century, a few miles out of the busy streets of Jerusalem is a lovely hamlet where Jesus frequently found rest and relaxation. A place, if you will, where he could kick off his sandals, sit down or even lay down for a nap. No one had an agenda in this family of Martha, the oldest, Mary, and probably the youngest, Lazarus. The home is called the home of Martha, so I take it she owns it. She's the oldest. I take it that none of them happens to be married. These are single adults. If they were, their mates are never mentioned in Scripture. So it's a neat family. Three grown kids, grown up together, living in this little place in Bethany. And Jesus, having come from a busy day and facing the ever-present shadow of the cross that was encroaching, increasing with increasing intensity as time was passing, found it necessary that afternoon to knock on the door and to have it open and to meet the faces of his friends, Martha and Mary. That's what brings us to verse 38 of Luke chapter 10. As they were traveling along, it's Jesus and some of his companions, his disciples. He entered a certain village, and we know it from other sections of Scripture that it's Bethany, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Now, for a moment, let's try to be very objective about this. It's easy to look at it through 19 centuries of time and wonder what all the hubbub was about. But just imagine the knock coming at your place at 6:15 this evening, and the house is kind of a wreck. The kids have made it look like the dogs have been loose in there for a couple of days. you haven't taken care of all the dirty diapers, and so it sort of stinks. Dishes are kind of spread around. You're hassled. You're facing the tests of tomorrow, and suddenly you open the door, and it's Jesus, of all people. Hi. Just thought I'd drop by for a couple of hours just to hang out, and you can appreciate now one of the responses, because some of you instantly kick into stress when you think of that. Others of you think, what a marvelous moment. You know, shovel the other stuff out of the way, sit down, kick back, relax. This is a moment. This is one of those divine serendipities. What a great chance for Jesus and me to talk and really to listen. And that was Mary's response, but not Martha's. She had a sister called Mary, who moreover was listening to the Lord's words, seated at his feet. But Martha, here's our word again, was distracted. It looks rather innocuous sitting there on the page, but you've been there, I've been there. Our nerves kick in a time like that. When you're Martha, you're the oldest, and you're therefore the most responsible. There are older, the oldest child is represented all through this place, and you who are watching on closed circuit television, you understand Martha. We have four kids, and our oldest is the most intense of the four. And I remember as he was growing up, he'd have, you know, tics at times, and it always bothered us. And it really did when I realized I was the cause of some of those tics that, in his life. And but he's responsible. It's just the middle name of every oldest child, or most of the oldest children. And Martha is that. So she immediately kicks in with, what am I going to serve him? Oh, man, I don't have enough lamb. I got to send somebody down to get a piece of meat. I got to, you know, fire up the stove. I gotta get the dishes. I gotta match the tablecloth. Gotta get the napkins. Dishes, oh, they're dirty. I gotta wash those up. Half-wit servant that's probably gonna mess something up back there. And she goes through all these gymnastics while Mary thinks, hey, this is great, man. I'm gonna hang out with Jesus. But that's not Martha's agenda. She's a worrier. And she's distracted with what? With all her preparation. Now, wait a minute. Who in the world asked Martha to prepare anything? But see, this is what you do when you're a type A. Martha's what I call a head nurse type. She's in charge. And she tends to run everybody in the family. She's going to put everybody in the right place. She's a controller. And she's distracted with all her preparations. And she came up to him and said, now hang on, you kind of picture her with her hands on her hips, apron sort of twisted, little beads of perspiration breaking out. She's been in that hot kitchen all alone, and she looks at Jesus, but she's really talking to Mary. Now you've been in a situation like, Lord, do you not care? And that's a great opening, huh? Lord, don't you care? I mean, he just relaxed, and he sits up on his elbow, and she's unloading a piece of her mind she can't afford to lose. And she said, do you not care that my sister has left me? She could have said to Mary, don't you care? But she's doing this diagonally so that Jesus will unload the truck on her. And if Jesus does it, then she'll get off her duff and get in the kitchen and get the stuff done. I mean, this lady's a nervous wreck. And she says, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? I mean, how much serving did she have to do? Well, when you're self-appointed controller, a lot is the answer to that. By the way, I don't know if you've ever heard Gary Smalley in his seminar as he divides people into categories of animals. Before you're insulted with that, it's really a good seminar. There are golden retriever types who are the cuddly, warm, encouraging type individuals that are always there, and some of you are golden retrievers. And then there are there are lions type who take charge, strong-willed, and get a job done, responsible. And then there are beavers, hard-working, diligent, often anonymous, work behind the scenes. And then there are otters. Otters. You ever seen otters? They just kind of live to play. And they're on their back, and they kick their tails, and they just swim all around the world. They just kind of play. And when they have babies, little babies, before they're able to swim, they're playing on top of their mother. Otters are usually the youngest in the family. My wife is the oldest in her family, and I'm the youngest in our family. And she said to me when we were going to have a picnic some time ago, and I was saying, I have to bring all that stuff. She said, you know what, honey? If only otters came to a picnic, all we'd have is balloons, just balloons. Nobody'd bring sandwiches, nobody'd bring Cokes, nobody'd bring chips, just everybody had a great time just kind of swimming back, kicking out. Well, that's Mary's hangout. She's a golden retriever otter. Martha is a lion beaver, okay? Now you got it. So she's unloading this thing on Jesus, and notice, after all of this statement, which revolves around her, a lot of single first-person pronouns here, and she says, then tell her to help me. I mean, that's really what she wanted to say, just come to the bottom line. You tell her to help me. Now, having been very objective with this and taking our shots at Martha's and Mary's, you know I'm not going to leave it there. Because in this room are some Martha types. I mean, the most marvelous opportunities for a divine serendipity when the Lord intersects our lives and brings an interruption that we don't think we've got time for, which really is at times a marvelous moment to have Him communicate deeply, personally, intimately. We miss it because we got our agenda. We didn't plan this. We all love Howie Hendricks. I think those of us who know the family love Jean just as much. Jean Hendricks, in her wonderful book for women, A Woman for All Seasons, writes very honestly, frustration is a very real problem. Some years ago, I was hostessing a Thanksgiving dinner in our little home, which happened to be short on kitchen counter space. The Lord and I had many conversations about the fact that the house was too small, but He kept saying, wait. And I was doing the best I could, I thought. Shortly before it was time to serve the meal, I slipped into the hot kitchen to check out my roasting turkey. As I was lifting it from one place to another in a space too tight for efficient operation, it slipped and fell right down on the floor. Two thoughts flashed. One, the floor is clean. And two, nobody's here. I've often thought about the people who read this who happened to be a part of that Thanksgiving party that night. I grabbed it and I lifted it to the platter, grateful that no one had witnessed my clumsiness. Suddenly, I felt a surge of self-pity. I leaned up against the wall and tears of frustration came to my eyes. In my heart, I said, Lord, I told you so. Now, look what's happened. It's all your fault. Then I heard their laughter and their talking from the other room, and suddenly I felt ashamed. What if somebody should come and see me crumpled in such dejection? I grabbed newspaper to put over the mess on the floor and decided I would have it out with the Lord later. I think I know a little of how Martha felt. Boy, and so do I. It would be embarrassing to tell you how many times I have been more like Martha than Mary. Missed choice moments. Because though an otter at heart, I tend to be too intense about each passing minute of my day. as if it were my day. Let me close with an equation. Let's add, subtract, multiply, and divide. Okay? Try this on. See if it helps. We begin each statement with "when I worry." When I worry, I add. When I worry, I add more things to an already full schedule. When I worry, I add pressure by thinking my image and reputation are involved in this. Well, that's a subtle one. What are they going to think about me? I add expectations to what hasn't yet happened. I add. Let's subtract. When I worry, I subtract God's presence from my crisis. Some of you are all worried about where you're going to go to school. Why worry? Just come to Dallas Seminary. I mean, that's the simplest thing in the world. There is no better place. I subtract God's presence from my crisis. I subtract prayer from my day. I subtract perspective from the moment. I subtract. When I worry, I multiply. You're with me on it by now. I multiply my problems by inserting my own solutions too rapidly. Well, I multiply my fears with my imagination. We have such fertile minds, and the thorns of worry somehow encourage imagination to run wild. I have literally, in the middle of the night, in anxiety, broken into a cold sweat, prompted only by worry. Never by prayer. Prayer somehow stops the sweating. But how quickly we forget. And I divide when I worry. I divide life into the secular and the sacred. Where in the world we came up with that, I've never been able to figure out. Since when is Monday secular, Sunday sacred? Since when is being in a building sacred and being in another facility secular? Since when is an interrupted moment secular and a planned moment sacred? I divide my day into the Lord's part and my business. Cynthia and I came to the seminary in 1959. We moved in July of 1959. Getting ready for school to begin the end of August, and there was no air conditioning. That was fun. It was about 108 when we woke up in the mornings. And I was at that time, and she and I were doing it together at breakfast. We were reading Hudson Taylor's two volumes on the whole beginning of inland China. In fact, his whole life, written by Son Howard. And I was impressed by one thing. I was just coming out of another world of work and business and the Marines and all of that. My life had been marked by all the things that characterize that kind of lifestyle. And I was deciding at that time I was gonna do things differently. But I wasn't going to announce it. And I said to her, why don't we just pray? Why don't we just pray for an air conditioner? Okay? Let's don't tell our mom and dad. Your mom and dad or my mom and dad would pool their resources and buy a little window air conditioner. And so let's don't do that. Let's just ask God to supply what we need. And I think it's the first time we decided we'd do that kind of thing without any word to anybody. We didn't tell the folks who lived next door. And boy, the walls were thin. I should add that. We could have been talking about it and they'd hear it. I remember telling her jokes and they'd laugh. That was such a thin wall there. So we decided we wouldn't announce it. We wouldn't talk about it. We wouldn't share it, you know, so everybody could pray with us, which is a nice way to say give to us. And we wouldn't do that. We'd certainly not mention it to our family. And we didn't. And so October came and November, and boy, it got cold. I remember praying. Those cold days for an air conditioner, it seemed strange that we'd do that. But all through the winter, we finished the two volumes, and we were more convinced than ever that we weren't going to get anxious about it. It was fine because it was cool. Of course, I knew, you know, April's coming, and May, June, July, August, September. You know, this hellish Dallas heat is going to be all over us. But, you know, it was an amazing thing. This makes us look great, this story does, but I want to tell you, we had spent 4 years as a married couple worrying about this and that, worrying about all kinds of stuff. We just decided it's going to be different now. We went to our parents' home in Houston for a quick visit and didn't tell anybody we were coming. Our folks knew, but nobody else knew. We visited my folks on the east side, drove over to where her folks lived, and before coming back, a couple hours that Sunday afternoon, we were together, had lunch, and the phone rang. Out of the blue, it was a friend of mine named Richard Parks who happened to attend a church we had attended there in Houston, and Richard said, "This Chuck?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Richard Parks." "Richard, how'd you know we were here?" "Well, I didn't. I just took a shot at it. Thought you might be there. Hey, you guys need an air conditioner?" Yeah, we do, matter of fact. He said, "You know, we just have redone our house here in near Memorial Drive," and he said, "We put in a central air, and we decided we don't need this little window, these window air conditioners, and you need more than one?" I said, "No, well, we just need one." He said, "I'll tell you, I got an almost new Fedders, 3/4-ton Fedders. Could you just stick it in the..." I said, "Yeah, yeah, you know, stick it in the back of the car. You bet. I could, you know, you could take it apart, not figuring how to put it back together. Bring it over." He brought that sucker over, stuck it in the trunk of the car. And we brought it back here and put it in a window. And, you know, man, I ran that thing day and night just to make sure it worked. And it kept us cool and kept the next folks who stayed there after we graduated. And for all I know, the next couple as well. And I learned a lesson about life. Worry solves nothing. Could have worried about that thing, and I just decided it was God's concern greater than mine. And all through the summer, even through the winters, we'd look at that thing. We were reminded God really does meet our needs. It's a good beginning to a life where I've seen him do that kind of thing over and over and over again. I'd like you to bow your heads for just a moment as I read the prayer of Peter Marshall. Don't usually read a prayer, but I want to do it here because it's so much on target, and this will conclude our time. Just let your eyelids block out all the other extraneous things that could interrupt your closing thoughts here and join with me. Father, we know it is not right for so much hope, joy, and peace to be stolen from us every day. Yet sometimes there seems to be no escape for us from the treadmill of our daily lives. We ask Thee to help us, to guide us into a finer way of living. Check our impulse to spread ourselves so thin that we are exposed to fear and doubt, to the weariness and impatience that makes our tempers wear thin and robs us of peace of mind, that makes skies gray when they should be blue, that stifles a song along the corridors of our heart. May we have the mercy of God to forgive us, the strength of God to make us resolute, the grace of God to be kind, tender, and affectionate one to another, and the patience of God to believe in the ultimate triumph of Thy work on earth. This we ask in his name in whom all peace resides.